Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, alcohol, the challenge of moderation. A seasonal reflection by the title of Waiting for Faustus. And our popular Latin lover, chats of papal spiritual exercises. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. Give up that extra drink and give the money saved to charity. That's the plea that Ireland's Catholic bishops are making in their pastoral letter for Lent this year. Entitled Alcohol, the Challenge of Moderation, the bishop's letter is prompted by Ireland's 40% increase in alcohol consumption over the past 10 years. This pastoral letter includes suggestions for limiting alcohol use, including the important recognition that the human person needs the support of others. In addition, the bishops suggest giving money to favourite charities rather than spend it on drinks, and reducing drinking, particularly during the Lenten season. Susie Hodges picks up the story.
Ireland has long had a reputation for its pub culture and its enjoyment of alcohol. But all too often, this love of drinking can end in drunkenness, and that's where the problem begins. Most of the drinking done by men in Ireland is binge drinking nowadays, and the levels of this habit are higher in Ireland than in any other European country. Faced with these alarming statistics, the Catholic bishops are urging the use of moderation when it comes to alcohol consumption in their pastoral letter for Lent. Eamon Walsh is the auxiliary bishop of Dublin and vice chair of the church's Drugs and Alcohol Initiative. He was one of the main authors of the bishop's pastoral letter and spoke to me about its aims.
The purpose behind it was people usually try and do some penitential act during the season of Lent, and we wanted to put to them a penitential act that would deal with the problem that we have in the country at the moment, which is the challenge of moderation in the use of alcohol. And the proposal was that if people agreed to abstain from alcohol or to reduce their intake by one-third at the end of Lent, to evaluate what effect did that have on their health, on their relationships, on the way they worked, and from a Christian point of view, what use did they put the resources that they saved? Did they use them to help the poor at home or in the third world? And could they motivate themselves to do this from the Christian perspective of reaching out to our brother as often as you did it to the least of my brothers, you did it to me?
Bishop Walsh believes that one of the main challenges facing people in Ireland is how to change this culture of drinking to excess.
The pastoral was to encourage the adult population to lead by example, and that is the best message that we can give our young people. Now, their approach to alcohol is the quicker they get high or smashed, as they call it, the better. While the older generation would try to keep control of themselves completely when drinking, and the whole notion of kind of getting what they call smashed just didn't enter into things. So that's a complete change around. And in addition to the reduction of alcohol was to start a debate to see how can we have responsible drinking that people can enjoy themselves and at the same time not drink to excess. And the example of the damage that's been done is that our casualty wards in the hospitals are chock-a-block with drink-related problems, that so much violence in home and on the streets is related to alcohol, and that the workforce performance is something that is damaged by it. People ask the question, is this something to do with the the Irish temperament. And I think I can't answer that, but what I can say is that if something is culturally acceptable, then it's more likely to be passed on from one generation to another. So we're trying to change that culture and say that moderation is enjoyment and healthy.
So why do so many young people indulge in so-called binge drinking, where the purpose is to get drunk as fast as possible by downing several drinks in quick succession? A question I put to Chris Murphy, who works for the church's social care agency Crosscare and acts as a counsellor for those suffering from alcohol abuse problems.
Well, in the case of the young people binge drinking, it is, as young people always have done, it's about pushing the boundaries. It's about testing new experiences. It's probably the same reason that people do bungee jumping or parachute jumping as well. It's pushing oneself to the extremes and it's looking to find out what it's like. So it's experimentation. But there's a huge difference between parachute jumping and drinking, which is the addictive property of alcohol. And it is much easier to get into something like binge drinking than to get out of it again. And I really think that we haven't encouraged people to debate these issues sufficiently so that they start to think about the consequences and the advisability for themselves. And in a way, that's what's behind this pastoral calling for a debate. I feel that a lot of Irish people ask the question, will I get away with it or not? In the young person's case, this question is about whether the parents will catch me or whether I'll get away with it. In a young adult's case, it may be whether the police will catch me drink driving or not, or whether I'll be able to get up for work in the morning. But we feel that there is a whole lot of other questions that people need to be able to ask themselves, and a whole other debate about the advisability of this kind of drinking for the whole person, the health, for their wealth, for their spiritual enrichment, for the family, and so on.
In Murphy's view, the negative fallout from the abuse of alcohol is far greater than many people realise, as he goes on to explain.
The drink driving statistics have been very worrying, but also events like the fact that at a weekend when young people are drinking, the A&D and the Rape Crisis Centre, the sexual assault clinics, have a lot of clients, and some of them think that their drinks have been spiked with drugs such as Rohypnol, a tranquilizer. In virtually every case, they find that alcohol itself is the cause of somebody having passed out and maybe having been sexually active without their own consent or having been the victim of sexual assault. So alcohol is having much greater effects than a lot of people are willing to admit. It is the cause of a lot of rows and a lot of marital disharmony. It is said that there are more children concerned about a parent's drinking than there are parents concerned about their children's drinking.
But how influential is sports sponsorship and advertising in persuading many people, especially the young, that drinking is cool and glamorous? Bishop Walsh again.
I would love a psychologist to give their view of what does it mean when you affix the name of an alcoholic beverage to a sporting event. And it's almost like as if you stencil that brand name on the minds of the young and all age groups on an occasion where it's highly emotionally charged, such as at a cup final or so forth. And you can't even look up on the television index of what programs are on without seeing the brand name of alcohol attached with the particular sporting event. I'm deliberately not using the names of events because I don't want to reinforce yet more.
When it comes, as you say, to advertisements, it's not just sponsorship in sporting events, but could it not be argued that advertising in general of alcoholic beverages portrays drinking as glamorous and fun, and this particularly must have an impact on the young?
Well, I would agree with that approach that it certainly does have an impact on the young, and they have restricted advertising in the context of smoking. And I would think that something similar should happen in alcohol.
Concern over high levels of cocaine abuse is also an issue in contemporary Ireland. But according to Bishop Walsh, what many people forget is that alcohol is also a drug and is far more widely abused.
It is the first drug of choice for 90% of the people. We have a lot of concern about cocaine and heroin. And I saw recently in one of the Italian programs what a big problem it is down in Naples. But it's still far less a problem than alcohol. But because so many of us indulge in alcohol, we feel uneasy to speak about this. And this pastoral letter is addressed to all professions. We're not taking a holier than thou. We're saying this is something that affects everybody, ourselves included. Let's all try and cut down by a third, or have at least have a debate about how much is it part of my life.
Ireland's economy has boomed over the past two decades, and it's now one of the world's richest countries. But Bishop Walsh believes that this newfound affluence, coupled with the pressures of today's fast-paced society, is helping to fuel the practice of drinking to excess.
We're in an Ireland that has great prosperity, but we have a drink problem that is coming at a time of prosperity, but pressure from work and family and commuting to work, and our people just easing their pressure with alcohol. And the message that's coming from, if you like, the consumer society is more is better. And what we're saying is more is not necessarily better, particularly in the context of alcohol.
As a counsellor, Murphy has come face to face with many people who are struggling to deal with their addiction to alcohol. He shares with us the story of one of his former clients.
A person called Pat who had come, and she has a good job, so she's a professional person, and she found herself quite often drinking so much that she would pass out in the evenings at home. It was just unwinding at the end of a day. It was comfort thing, and it was de-stressing because her work was definitely stressful. What she didn't know was that some of her colleagues had also noticed. Now, a person like her was struggling with her own willpower to try to pull herself together, and she was quite willing to come for counselling. But I think that the big insight that happened for her was when she stopped relying on her own willpower, because a friend from work eventually got her and said, listen, I know what you're going through because I've been through it as well. And these two people managed to develop a good relationship, and she became willing to take help and to accept support from other people and stop relying on her willpower. Then she sorted herself out, and she's doing very well at the moment.
It's tough enough for the person who is suffering from a drink problem. But Murphy says their addiction also has a heavy impact on their family, as he explains in this anecdote involving that same woman's daughter.
The mother had gone drinking after a golf match one night, and when the daughter found out, she smashed up the golf clubs and went into a really strong rage, which again helped the mother to take her own problem more seriously. It is very heartrending and very frustrating for family members. And yet a family can't sort out a drinker in the family. It has to come from outside.
Heavy drinking and being drunk often is seen as just harmless fun. But experts say the sobering reality is that alcohol addiction can tear a family apart and destroy a life. I'm Susie Hodges.
Well, my thanks there go to Susie there and her guests, who are the Auxiliary Bishop of Dublin, Eamon Walsh, who's also one of the authors of the Bishop's Pastoral Letter, and Chris Murphy, who works for the Church's social care agency, Crosscare, and acts as counsellor for those suffering from alcohol abuse problems. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast on a more reflective note, it's time to join well-known author and theologian, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins.
Confessions, the great Saint Augustine of North Africa wrote about his experiences and beliefs before he became a Christian. For 9 years, Augustine belonged to a group called the Manichees. Manichaeism was a religion which started in ancient Persia and which despised the material side of our human existence. According to the Manichees, there's a spark of light within us. That spark needs to be delivered from darkness and the evil material side of things. After a while, St. Augustine naturally began to have serious difficulties about the beliefs of the Manichees. But he decided to wait for a special Manichaean teacher who was going to come and untangle all the difficulties that Augustine felt. This special teacher, Faustus, lived out of town. Once Faustus arrived, everything was going to be cleared up. All Augustine's questions would be answered, his problems would be solved, and life would really begin. But when Faustus arrived, none of that happened. Intellectually, Faustus was no match for Augustine. Faustus simply couldn't answer the deep difficulties Augustine felt about the beliefs of Manichees. Augustine had been suffering from what might be called the waiting for Faustus syndrome. Now, I wonder whether we too may sometimes suffer from the waiting for Faustus syndrome. One day, somebody truly special is going to arrive from Bangalore, from San Francisco, or from Kyoto. And that person is going to tell me what life's really about. One day I will take the course or find the book which is really going to get my spiritual life started for the first time. If we do suffer from the waiting for Faustus syndrome, we just might miss seeing Jesus right there in the ordinary things and right there before the ordinary faces of our daily existence. In the people and the chances that make up our regular routine, Jesus has already come. We don't need to hang on, waiting for some Faustus. Jesus already speaks to us and acts for us now, through the things and the occasions and the persons we know very well. Can we afford to let our lives slip away, waiting for some Faustus? Can we afford to postpone living, as we dream about someone or something who will turn up one day, explain it all to us, and fix everything up for us? In a wonderful passage, St. Paul insists, "Now is the acceptable hour, now is the day of salvation." There's no need to wait for anyone else. Jesus is already among us. We can't afford to miss Jesus. To do that would be to let slip the acceptable hour and to let slip the day of salvation in which we already find ourselves. St. Augustine suffered from the waiting for Faustus syndrome. But Augustine also had a hungry, restless heart. His deep hunger and restlessness eventually put him in the presence of Jesus. There his hunger was satisfied, and he found a peace that no one could ever take from him. He never again gave in to any waiting for Faustus syndrome.
Our thanks there to well-known author and theologian, Jesuit Father Gerald O. Collins. And finally, on a totally different note, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. The topic of our conversation this week, well, spiritual exercises. Father, when one feels one's not worth a pin, it may be time to do one's spiritual exercises. How would you translate that?
Well, come say quis sentit a nihili esse, nihili esse. Tunc tempus est ut exercitia spiritualia faciat.
To find light at the end of a tunnel.
Ut lumen in extremo cuniculo reperiat. That you can, all this stuff is easy. That's easy.
So as to change our spiritual lives in a twinkling of an eye.
Ictu oculi, the famous twinkling of an eye. Ut ictu oculi vitam nostram spiritalem mutare possimus.
and give our spiritual lives a bit of spit and polish.
Spit and polish, my lord. Oh, per polire, you'd probably say to just polish. Would Vitam Nomba, they wouldn't say that. The Romans wouldn't say that, but anyway.
They wouldn't be so vulgar.
No, they wouldn't. They would Vitam Nostram Spiritalem Perficiamus. Although spit and polish would be per poliamus, that we polish off our spiritual lives, but these Cicero wouldn't understand that expression. It's just something else.
At any rate, now I want to speak about something serious, which are spiritual exercises in the Vatican, a practice which began in 1929, the year of the Lateran Pax.
I didn't know that.
With Pius XI, obviously, who admired St. Ignatius. Well, how does one say spiritual exercises?
Well, the exercitia spiritualia. That's
that comes from straight from Latin.
Yes, actually, yes. The first translations of St. Ignatius in Latin had that.
In my Catholic school, we used to say we would go on retreat.
Yeah, retreat is ad recessum. Recessum spiritualem ire. Recessum, to go in the background. That we can say, it's very beautiful. So the fact is, the way I live is in recessu perpetuo. I'm always on some sort of a retreat because, like, I'm all alone in my room. That's a recessu, to be off.
At any rate, the people who live in the Vatican, headed by the Pope, they go on spiritual exercises each year.
He goes on exercises.
The Pope and the papal household accompanies him. That's the correct terminology, the papal household. How does one say papal household?
Well, that's the Domus Pontificia.
In 1922, there was an apostolic constitution, Summorum Pontificum. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, so far.
In which St. Ignatius was proclaimed patron of spiritual exercises. You mentioned St. Ignatius tied to spiritual exercises, no?
Yes.
In fact, many of the preachers, these retreats in the papal household, were Jesuits.
Yes, and that's the terminology came down from that. I'd like to know, you don't know any of the next words of Summorum Pontificum.
No.
But my students would go crazy over that kind of a beginning of a pontifical document of the Roman pontiffs. And of course, in Latin, you don't know what's happening.
Why?
Well, because you don't know how the sentence is going to end. The will of the Roman pontiffs, the custom of the Roman pontiffs, but the document begins with Summorum Pontificum.
So,
we love that kind of stuff.
In other words, you understand the meaning, you have to read the whole sentence.
Well, certainly. You ask my students, they'll club you on the head if you don't give them that answer.
How do you say club you on the head in Latin?
Te verberabunt in capite.
At any rate, spiritual exercises in the Vatican were frequent but not annual until basically 1929, when there was an encyclical, Mens Nostra, which focused on spiritual exercises, right?
There's Mens Nostra. There's another beautiful. Go on.
Tell me, the Mens
Nostra.
Our
mind, our mentality, our thought. Our thought, Mens Nostra.
Just in two words.
One
of the things that Pius XI, who was Pope at the time, said in that encyclical is that the great disease of the modern era is the lack of reflection. This was 1929.
Poof, we can imagine today.
How would you translate that?
I don't know what he said.
The great disease of the modern era.
Ergo nescio maxima egritudo recensioris aetatis est. Is what?
Is the lack of reflection.
Of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Est manca, vel parva deliberatio, parva contemplatio. Oh, you can say it very nicely.
Since then, spiritual exercises have taken place in the Vatican almost annually, not always. During the Second Vatican Council, they were suspended, I think, for a while. But curiously, Pope John the 23rd held the exercises once, just right ahead of the Second Vatican Council, in the tower in the Vatican Gardens.
Mm.
It made me think of, you know, John the 23rd loved the gardens in the Vatican, and it was like he was leading all the papal household up the garden path.
Yeah, I don't think he was leading, but anyway, he was there and maybe they came up there.
At any rate, what I'm getting at is, how do you say in Latin leading someone up the garden path, which Pope John wasn't doing?
Per hortorum, semitam ducebat pontificiam domum. Leading house through the path of the gardens.
Whereas lead someone up the garden path in British English is to deceive, trick, to entice with false promises of fair prospects.
That's all right, but it's British.
Yeah, which isn't what John the 23rd was doing, but how do you say that in Latin? Sorry.
Well, that would be decipere or fallere or fraudari or frustrari. There are many words to deceive.
One curious thing is that at the time of Pope Pius the 12th, a complaint was lodged, I believe, by Papa Pacelli himself, that the preacher was delivering what he referred to in Italian as a nobile mattone, which I'm quoting someone.
A noble brick? What does that mean?
He was saying that it was very heavy going. How would you translate the Italian, nobile?
Well, when I say nobile mattone, is later nobilis, which doesn't make any sense at all in Latin, but that's all right.
How would you give
one
the gist of...
Bravi or sermo, it was a rather heavy talk.
We were talking about John the 23rd Tower in the Vatican Gardens, but actually the spiritual exercises today take place in the Redemptoris Mater chapel. That's a chapel with a Latin name.
Mm-hmm. Redemptoris Mater.
Which means?
Mother of the Redeemer, which is the title of...
Pope John Paul's encyclical.
Go on the Blessed Mother.
Actually, before becoming Pope, when he was Archbishop of Krakow, he preached one of the retreats, one of the spiritual exercises. Becoming one of the first non-Italians to preach in the Vatican.
Go on.
Do you think the fact that many of the cardinals now come from different countries right across the world, do you think that changes the use of Latin within the Church?
Certainly it has, in the sense that many of these people might not know Latin well enough. Many of these people were trained here in Rome, got their degrees here in Rome, and so Italian is more accessible and easier for them. And so it's
also because, Latin is part of our Western cultural heritage, but some of these people don't come from.
I have Orientals who know Latin very, very well, but you have to be trained, you see. And some of these people, even the Orientals, would feel more at home with Italian because they lived here for a few years and got their degrees here. And, they say, to think of Latin would be like a headache for them, which is very unfortunate. I have friends, when I meet them, we start speaking Latin immediately, you see. And the general of my order, and I hadn't seen him for, 25 years, and I saw him in summer, and the first thing, we just started speaking Latin. That was the end of it.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.